is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is a longtime student of the videos on 9/11. He's been very active on a lot of threads, and I've been very impressed with his work. He produced some of the earliest studies intended to demonstrate video fakery, which I guess were just too hot to handle, and they've been removed from YouTube, which is, in my opinion, a great loss. I hope that we'll be able to retrieve them and talk about them. His handle is Genghis. He lives in Australia, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to the show, Genghis.
Thanks, Jim.
Did you have a chance to listen to the program yesterday where I had Field McConnell and John Lehrer as my guests?
I didn't, but I want to download it and check it out. Have you got it uploaded to your site?
I'm sorry?
Have you got it uploaded to your site? Because I wouldn't want to listen. I've been at work, but I couldn't.
Yeah. Actually, for 24 hours after programs, they're available by demand on the Genesis network. So if you just go to gcnlive.com, click on demand, they'll show the names of all the shows, and then you just click again on demand, and you automatically have it available.
Excellent. I've been in the email debate, as you know, between all the Boeing nerds. So it'd be interesting to hear what they've got to say live.
Well, you know, I've been fascinated by the absence of any complaints about the way the program went. I think it was perhaps among the best I've ever had the opportunity to host. Both of them are extremely highly qualified. Turns out that McConnell comes from a family that's distinguished for its history of flying. I mean, it really has an extensive background in flying. So that, I think, added an additional dimension.
Did you say you were surprised you didn't get any complaints about it?
Yeah.
Is that what you said?
Yes. Yes, I am, because if anyone had detected the least smidgen of partiality or bias, if I hadn't been very even-handed, I know, Genghis, there would have been an avalanche of complaints, and there hasn't been one. In fact, it's interesting that both John Lehrer and Field McConnell tended to discount Joe Keith's argument, which surprised me somewhat. On the other hand, today I received an email from Joe, which was very disarming, saying that, here's how it started off. Yes, Jim, I thought your program yesterday was your best ever, even though I was made out to be the whipping boy or fall guy. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, I'm just kidding. I'm glad to be assistance in generating an interesting debate, which this one really was. And he goes on to say some things about the conditions under which he was being interviewed. Most importantly, perhaps, he had been talking with pilots in the past and became rather convinced in the past that, here's a paragraph of an enclosure. At low altitude and high density and pressure, engine vibration is greatly magnified, but I have no idea what the exact limits are, except that when max power is reached and air intake backs up in front of the plane, drag would be increased to such an extent so as to cause stalling. That, of course, is an argument that John Lehrer has elaborated at great length. This is Joe Keith now continuing. Over the last 6 years, I've spoken to several 767 pilots and Boeing engineers who alluded to this and who seemed to agree that flutter started at about 220 miles an hour and disintegration would begin at 330. But lately, I've received much static regarding this. Flutter is a low-frequency vibration, so this is not what caused jetliners to disintegrate at high altitudes in the 50s. We should be able to get all this info directly from Boeing. My question is, why is it so hard to get this info when it is beyond any doubt that all WTC-2 crash videos are fake? Being an old planer is heresy, almost like denying the divinity of Christ or even denying the Holocaust. Thank God they haven't made denying the moon landings a heresy yet, or I may find some good friends of mine in trouble, including most of the engineers I work with at North American. What is the world coming to? Are we running out of oil and heading back to the Middle Ages? I think he's not too far off the mark there, Genghis.
No. I mean, there's these going on arguments about maximum speed that really no one's going to go out and test it. So he's been running with his estimates, but there's not going to be anything written down on paper about what the maximum speed of a Boeing is. So they're always going to argue about this stuff, and I suspect in different conditions it's always going to be different as well.
Well, actually, I think, you know, Boeing has this kind of information, and it's relatively standard, and it's got to be printed many places. It's just that, and I think the reasons are obvious in retrospect, it's very difficult to get the information out of Boeing so that, you know, it appears
too vague. They have these words that don't really mean top speed. They have threshold boundary sort of limits, and they have this own jargon that we find hard to comprehend. Where they just don't have something saying top speed, which is what we want.
Yeah.
You know, systems want.
Yeah, at different altitudes, right, at between 700 and 1,000
yeah.
feet.
And I
like your comments. What you were commenting in relation to the threat, of course, when you made these observations, but I thought they were quite astute because Field and John and I were talking about doing some kind of simulation, you know, getting a simulator and putting them in as pilots to see if they could bring a 767 to anything like 560 or hit the buildings. And you observe that they operate on the basis of programs which are, of course, implementing algorithms. So if you knew the algorithms, you would know the performance capabilities that were built into the simulator.
Exactly. A guy had to sit down and put in the parameters for the machine in the first place, and the software runs on a normal algorithm which they've got from real life.
Or from some source. One would have presumed that they got it from Boeing, which would suggest that, you know, Boeing has the information. If Boeing doesn't, one wonders who would.
Yeah. And they can maybe extrapolate from the known algorithm, but it's still from just facts they have on a sheet.
You mentioned in relation to the idea of a simulation, you this is just quoting from a recent post of yours. My point here is that this sounds like a good idea, but I wouldn't hinge the whole no plane debate on it. I would like to see the outcome. It's a very good test, but let's not get all double or nothing about it, guys. I think you're absolutely right about that. And the point I've made is that, because they are based on programs, and programs can be revised, I mean, we would need to know that this was authentic, and the only way we could do that, actually, technically, would be by studying the program itself to determine whether it properly implemented the algorithms and hadn't been altered.
Exactly.
That where, you know, those who might alter a program, try to reprogram it, presumably would be those who want to change the performance capabilities of the plane to make it appear as though it could do something that it couldn't. So that, in my judgment, if we conducted these kinds of tests, that a negative outcome would be more significant than a positive one.
Yeah, I wouldn't take either reading from it, because it's been programmed like that, I would rather see the raw stats that they built the software from, and then you'd have an idea of where they were going with it. But you could also get a simulator off the net, just a game simulator, and just run that on your PC, and that'll tell you the same information, because it'll be the same algorithm. You know, you don't need to be
That's quite fascinating. Stand by, we'll be right back with my special guest, Genghis. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid.
Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Verrilli. You can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. We're having a conversation about evidence related to video fakery on 9/11 with Genghis, who's offered some of the earliest videos intended to demonstrate what was going on here, which have been apparently too hot to handle and were removed involuntarily from YouTube. What happened there, Genghis? Just to pursue that issue for the moment.
Well, to my original channel, I pulled my own channel at the start, but I've had videos and channels removed since. But it's hard to say what they get. I've been censored more over copyright than I have over 9/11, I think, Jim, in the end. So I haven't been treated too badly on YouTube. But they don't like truth at all on YouTube, as you know. But I've been censored over copyright more times than not.
Well, let's come back to this in a moment. First of all, I'd like to say that Rob Basalmo, who is the head of co-founder and the head of Pilots for 9/11 Truth, has made observations about past attempts to conduct simulations by qualified 767 pilots. And there's one available on YouTube, an interview he did, that I'd like to play. It'll take a good part of the segment, but then we can talk about it afterwards. It's entitled Pilots Discuss Difficulty of WTC Attacks. Let me see if I can get this going.
Bringing the truth to America. This is Truth Net Radio.
She was a black hat beauty with big dark eyes and points all her own, sitting way up high. Way up high. I passed the cornfields when the wind got heavy.
Welcome back to the program, ladies and gentlemen.
Working on mysteries.
Revolution Radio Live right here on the TruthNet Radio Network. I'm your host, Mike Swenson. TruthOrLies.org is my website. RevolutionRadioLive.com is my other website. TruthNetRadio.com is the network website. Most of the time, they don't even give us two sides.
Yeah, exactly. But when I was on 9/11, I was actually in the simulator training a class of new pilots. Normally what we do is we we'll train, train the pilots with one instructor, and then I'll turn them over to another instructor to finish up their training. And then I come back and give them their check ride. You never want the same pilot that trains, the same check airman that trains the pilot to give the check ride, and basically their test. And, we're in the middle of giving these guys their last, sim period before I'm going to pass them on to another instructor. And we come out for a break and 9/11 is happening, planes had hit the tower, and somebody in the break room had a TV, and we kind of watched it in awe. And,
mm-hmm.
Like everybody else, just horrified and upset and everything else that the country could be attacked like this. And this was in Phoenix, and of course they closed the airport right away, so I wasn't going anywhere. And so we decided to go back into the simulator the next day. And after their sim training period, I said, "Hey guys, let's try something. Let's see if we can hit these buildings, like we saw happen."
Yeah.
And this was in a 737, and a smaller, a lot more maneuverable airplane. And so I set it up for these pilots, and keep in mind these pilots are you know, have many years of experience. And I set up New York, and we, you know, they all just took turns trying to hit the buildings, and they couldn't do it unless they slowed down to almost landing speeds.
Wow. I didn't know that. Tell me about that.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and they could not hit those buildings at the high speeds. They couldn't do it.
Yeah, well, I guess they were getting into all kinds of Dutch roll and everything then, right?
Well, that's right. That's exactly what was happening.
Things to remember about the Dutch roll. Firstly, there is a damping ratio, which is how quickly the motion dies down. There's a frequency, which is the speed of the motion itself. And there's the roll to yaw ratio, which is a measure of how much roll, how much bank angle, to how much side slip. And those are the three aspects that you have to assess. And they're all important in their own way.
So with Dutch roll problems, if people don't realize that to hand fly an airliner at those speeds is extremely difficult. It's very hard to hand fly an airplane at those speeds, and particularly if you're a novice, because a novice that's learned and all of their experience is on little airplanes, they over control everything. But you gotta understand, going, 300 knots in an airliner, and you move the controls like you would expect to do in a little airplane.
Right.
Well, I mean, you couldn't stand the G-forces. Everything has to be just fingertip control. So basically, out of the 10 times each guy did it, nobody could do it. I finally was able to do it on probably the last time. I jumped up there and tried it. And but I'm telling you, that kind of opened their eyes, and I said, something is not right.
The other thing that comes to mind at those speeds, these aircraft are flying 100, 200, 100, 150 knots over VMO. And, you get into what's called aileron reversal, roll reversal at those speeds because of adverse yaw and all kinds of other things. But not to mention control surface flutter. I mean, I don't know if that's built into the sim, Dan. Was that built into the sim?
It's built into the sim. Did the sims start to come apart? These sims actually have crash logic where they check G forces and everything else. The simulators, for the public out there, the simulators are so good that I could take a pilot that has never been in a 737. I could train him all the way through. And the first time he ever steps foot in the real aircraft is with a plane load full of paying passengers.
That's right.
And that's how good that those simulators are.
That's called the level D.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Evolution, well, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Genghis, who's in Australia and who's been studying the videos of 9/11 with great suspicion, who's posted a series of studies, and we're going to be discussing them in a few moments. But Genghis, although I lost track, I couldn't hear the sound come up there, and we didn't get to hear it all, I guess. You got the idea that here you have Rob Basalmo, who's a founder of Pilots for 9/11 Truth, who had a group of experienced pilots with him on 9/11. They were working with a simulator, and they decided to go back in the simulator the next day
It was a simulator for a 737, which is a smaller and more maneuverable plane. He had each of them take 10 tries. None of them were able to hit the building at high speed. The only way they could do it was if they slowed down virtually to landing speed.
Yeah, it totally. That's the whole irony. If you were going to do this, if it was real, and you came from that height at that distance and tried to drop at that speed, the last thing you'd do is do it at full stick. I mean, you're lucky to. If these are amateurs, it's the last way you do it. It almost completely sort of debunks the idea of pilots at all, because you wouldn't do it at full stick. It'd be hard enough just to hit the things. And I have no doubt that doing it past the manufacturer's speed would make it a little bit harder.
Would this be, in your opinion, one of the principal reasons for faking the videos, namely that it's damn near impossible to do it if you're actually flying a plane?
Yeah, well, as you know, there were no planes, so they had to fake the videos to make, you know, for later, for closer inspections, that make it look like what they were told happened. But that's not the idea that's amongst the planes, though. So we know they can't travel that speed. It's obvious. So.
Well, I think it's obvious, and that Fields' empiricism, you know, his desire to do actual flying a plane, I think reflects the cockiness of a jet fighter pilot, though I think Fields is a completely admirable guy. But where they tend to believe they could land a B-52 on a postage stamp, for example, combined with his, lack of background, I think, with regard to aeronautical engineering, and the principles of aerodynamics, so that he's really not very open to a purely an argument based in theory, you know, even though it's rooted, of course, in laws of aerodynamics, which can't be violated and can't be changed.
Yeah. He's used to, you know, jet fighter planes, and I think that's that idea of you give it more stick and it's going to go faster. But, I mean, if this plane... Well, that's the other thing as well. If they had this plane up to full stick, full speed, can you imagine how much it's shaking? Can you imagine trying to pilot it as an amateur with this thing jumping up and down 10 feet in the air every time it hits an air pocket?
Yeah.
It's not designed to go at that speed in that denser air. So it would make it so hard. I just think he's very gung-ho because he's a fighter pilot and he thinks it can be done. And also, I notice he's done comparisons in the email debates between engines and what's left of the engine debris. And I notice he demonstrates this through his Phantom 4 test and the speeds also through Phantoms. And these are turbojet engines, not turbofan. Now, there's a big difference, and I notice this gets ignored a lot. A turbofan's a big, wide-mouth, delicate motor. A turbojet is an earlier jet. It's a very simple, it burns a lot more simply, and it's smaller, and it can actually crush a lot more air through.
Field invited John to expound on the differences between the turbofan and turbojet engines, which he did, during the program yesterday. I think you'll like it when you get a chance to look at it, and we'll have to talk about it more. Let me just say that it seems to me that we already have had attempts to conduct simulations. It is true that Rob Bassamo claimed that on his last effort that he was able to hit the building, but apparently it was extremely difficult to do. It's certainly nothing we would expect any of these alleged hijackers to have been capable of doing. And in fact, in a 767, which is a larger and more difficult plane to maneuver, it might be that even Rob Bassamo would have been unable to hit the building.
Exactly. And it's interesting now that we say it. I wish we'd get more information off him. I mean, to find out if you could get to that speed in the 737, because it would be a similar equation, but it'd be interesting to see if he got that plane to go that fast. It's not something he mentions on that tape, I don't think.
Well, he implies they were going, you know, somewhere around 500 miles an hour anyway.
Yeah.
He seems to imply that, saying that the only way they were able to actually hit the building was if they slowed down to near landing speed, which, of course, is getting very, very slow indeed. I mean,
yeah, that's about 150 mile an hour.
Yeah, so. That's right. So, I mean, in order to be able to land a big plane like this to overcome ground effect, you have to slow down substantially, or you could never get it on the ground.
And the controls are all set up to fly sweetly at that point. That's when they want to land. And these things aren't designed to fly at that density. That's the thing. They're designed to fly at over 30,000 feet.
That's actually right. Yeah, John was pointing that out, how, you know, FAA no longer permits flight at some of these higher speeds, so that they're not designed to do it, except, of course, at high altitude. So.
Yeah, they're just designed to fly at that one place. And when they take off, you'll notice with these commercial airlines, they just go straight up to 30,000 feet, then they come straight down at the other end. They don't muck around in between ever, because that's just not where they're meant to fly. The air's just too dense.
Let me ask, what got you involved in the study of these videos, Genghis?
I don't really know. I mean, that to me is where the only smoking gun that's left is. I always knew inside job, you know, but I never, until I started looking at the videos, probably 2004, and I started noticing the problems were there. You know, when you get to a strange website and it says, look at this video, you know, you're sort of thinking it's skeptical at first, but you keep looking and the questions always remain, and the Fairbanks still looks weird. You know, the Foreman shot still looks weird. The ghost plane still looks weird.
Yeah.
Me, I haven't got to a point where I've found those sites to be telling me any lies. Well, a lot of them do, but you have to pick through and find. But there's so many problems with these videos that it doesn't take a genius to sort of to say it's not case solved yet.
Well, you produced four early studies that I even still have archived on Scholar's website under New Studies, and yet, of course, if I try to access them, I'm told that it's unavailable because of some kind of use agreement violation.
Yeah,
and you're suggesting that was related to copyright issues?
Yeah, I use music. That's my own fault to some degree. I use music. I just use people's music without asking them, and it's the done thing on YouTube, but I never really, these are just pieces of work to get an idea across at one moment in time. They're not usually meant to stand.
It's a music issue that was raised?
Yes, definitely. With Taboo, the Patsy Cline, the crazy song in the Butterplane section, that always gets flagged.
I can't believe that. I mean, that's such an old song, I can't believe it's still covered by copyright.
But they do this thing where they flag it and say they'll take some of your profits in the future, but, you know, there's never any profit. So, and then it usually disappears, and I'm not sure what you can do about it at that point.
Could you give us a verbal description of what we would find if we were looking at your four studies? Start with the first.
Which one? Are you talking about Flatline, or are you talking
about...
Yeah,
I'm talking about the Flatline series.
Flatline was an overview of all four.
We'll pick it up here with my special guest,
right.
Genghis. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. Genghis, we're just starting to talk about your four studies in a Flatline series, and I'm very interested in what you had in each of those, which are, alas, not available because of this issue related to music. Could you tell us a bit about them?
Yeah, it's easy. It's really it was the precursor to Taboo, and it's generally the same thing. It's the There Were No Planes idea, but it includes the 93 hoax and the 77 hoax as well. So it was about 9/11 in total, not just the World Trade Center. Taboo became just about the World Trade Center. So yeah, the difference, the only difference. It was a precursor. It was a bit rough. I was just, it's where the crash physics ideas kind of started.
Were you looking at the same videos that have become the focus of subsequent discussions?
Yeah. I mean, there's a set of known videos now that, you know, we were all looking at, and we've all been looking at for a long time anyway. There was no new ones in there. You know, there's only 40 second strike videos, so and the really big obvious ones are right in front of us, and they're always the same ones: Fairbanks, Foreman, Heather Carney. Yeah, I was looking at them, I think, if I remember rightly. But also at the Shanksville hole, you know, I spent some time looking at the Pentagon hole and the Shanksville hole, you know, where they should have faked a plane crash at least. But that's
yes, I know, that's so pathetic. They even claimed that it went into a, you know, disappeared into an abandoned mine shaft, which is beyond all credibility. Plus, of course, we know what to do with miners trapped in mine shafts. We bring out the heavy equipment. We work night and day under intensive lights in the hope that by some miracle someone may have survived. None of this, of course, was done here. I'm sure you know Colonel George Nelson, U.S. Air Force retired, has observed that it looked to him as though someone had come out there with a bulldozer, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up.
It was a very strange sight. In fact, I would go as far as to say that it looked so bad and so unprepared that something went wrong for them. It wasn't a planned sight. It was just a field with a hole in it, surely, you know, a stray missile or something. That's what happened there. I can't explain it. They didn't even do a half-assed job.
You know, I'll bet you're right. That would account for it, that something went wrong and with Flight 93, and they had to hastily prepare a fake crash site. And the best they could do was something that approximated what George Nelson described. Bring a bulldozer out, fill it with trash, blow it up, get this phony photograph to be taken. Keep the photographers and reporters, you know, 1,000 yards away. And then just sort of tidy up the site, trim all the trees so you take down all the burnt parts so they couldn't be subjected to chemical analysis to discover what caused them to be singed. And, you know, hope that no one will pay attention to the reporters who were saying at the time that the most striking feature of this crash site was that there was no evidence that any plane had crashed there.
And ever since they don't let you near the site, even now. You know, there could be radiation or but they also smudge it out on Google Earth. You can't look at the 93 crash site on Google Earth. It's just a smudge.
You can't even Google it?
No, on Google Earth you can't see it.
Really?
Like the Pentagon, yeah, they smudge things out so that you can't see detail, and that's one of the places they smudge.
What more obvious indication of consciousness of guilt could you have than appearing in a purported crash site to make sure no one can study to verify whether it is or isn't a crash site?
Yeah, exactly.
Genghis, this is truly disgusting. By the way, I received a copy of an email from John Lear, which he sent to Joe Keith. And Joe had said in his earlier message, of which I read part, he said, "Jim, I now agree with everything John Lear says about possible speeds, but if by some act of God, John and Field get that simulation to attain 560 miles an hour and hit the building, I still won't be able to reject my no-planer philosophy, because I still know that planes don't meld into steel in concrete buildings. They crash against them, even if they're DU-tipped. And in trying to be facetious, I see nothing wrong with an aeronautical engineer calling an engine a motor. Don't worry, Jeff. I still likely, if you did get me into trouble," that's Jeff Hill who'd called him and interviewed him, "in impossible speed. You have been one of the biggest levelers in this no-plane movement. I wouldn't change a thing, regards to all, Joe Keith." And John Lair wrote back, "Hello, Joe, sorry you got thrown under the bus. Even an act of God couldn't make a Boeing 767 go 560 miles an hour at sea level. It just can't happen. Field McConnell seems to be a good guy, but basic aerodynamics restricts a Boeing 767 from exceeding much more than 360 knots. All the best, John Lair." I think that very much sums up where the situation stands. And, of course, I thought that the observation by the aeronautical engineer Ben Eady, who explained that the engines, the Pratt & Whitney engines, couldn't produce enough energy, which would be six times what would be required in air that's only one-third as dense at 35,000 feet. I thought that the arguments here were definitive. So
they should be able to at least produce a Boeing going quick at that speed now. Nobody has. I mean, they're all still arguing over 300, 400, 500. You know, if any of these people had actual data to say, well, they can at least travel 400 to 500, they would have put it on the table. Nobody has. The fact that we're still arguing about this, for me, is a big problem.
Yeah.
You know, do they have an example of the top speed that would just make us look like fools? Because if we've got this many people arguing over it now, does it, you know, is there a time when we just have to produce an example? And John Lear believes in holograms. What do you think about that?
Holograms.
All the different answers. I mean,
John has suggested that possibility. I'm inclined to think it was something much simpler, but he's trying to account for why you had witnesses who seem sincere and to claim to have seen the films. I think there are many fewer witnesses that fall in this category than say Anthony Lawson likes to allege, where he talks about thousands. It's obviously vastly smaller than that. Peggy Carter, who's very active in 9/11 New York, has told me many times how it's easy to find somebody who claims to know somebody who actually saw the planes, but it's very difficult to find anybody who claims they actually saw the planes. This is a part, of course, from the videos, and after you've seen them on the videos once or twice, false memory syndrome tends to click in, and you tend to believe you saw something that you actually only saw on television.
Exactly. Even yesterday, Anthony Lawson was claiming that Brian Gumbel saw the plane, and Brian Gumbel didn't see the plane. That's the whole irony. But he did after three replays in the live feed. He starts to go, oh, there it is, there it is. He's got it close up. He's got it on a replay, and he's got it in slow motion, and suddenly he can see it. And now Anthony Lawson's counted him as a witness. Not only has Brian Gumbel seen it on TV, he's seen it after three replays with somebody pointing it out with a finger. He didn't see it live. So how does this make him a plane witness? And this is the thing people go through. They watch a video replay, and suddenly they watch one thing, and then they watch the replay of this, what they think is the same thing, and then the same thing, and it confirms their own memory. That's what I saw. They will replace the original.
That's right.
The replay.
It's one thing to have a certain experience and perception. It's another to remember it, and it's yet a third to report what it is you claim that you remembered based on direct experience.
I would like to see them with the effect of no media. What did they see? Like, if you walked up to them on the day, and this is why the live video becomes so important, because if you walked up to them on the day and said, what did you just see? That's the only time you would get the answer right, because after that, they step out into TV land, they go straight down the street, and somebody says, it's a big plane, and they just keep hearing the word.
Yeah.
After that, they have no chance. The evidence has no chance.
Absolutely right. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Genghis. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is from Australia. He uses the handle Genghis, and he's a longtime student of the videos of 9/11, and has made many significant contributions to discussion and debate, including producing a series of videos that are, I'm sorry to say, presently unavailable. Genghis, I'm very interested in what you take to be the most important arguments for video fakery. Of course, I recently offered five of them in a piece entitled New Proof of Video Fakery on 9/11, which anyone can find on the net. And emphasize that yesterday we were just talking about the first, which was the impossible speed argument, where there were three sub-arguments supporting it, namely that vibrations would be induced under those conditions of flying a 767-200 with conventional equipment at 560 miles an hour at 700 to 1,000 feet, which would cause the plane to shake apart Well, this is a Joe Keith argument. He was the guy who actually designed the shaker system for Boeing. That while that is the cruising speed of this plane at 35,000 feet, the air is three times more dense at 700 to 1,000 feet, and the engines could not suck it up. That's John Lear's argument as a professional pilot extraordinaire. And finally, that the Pratt & Whitney engines couldn't produce enough energy, which would be six times what would be required in air that is only one-third as dense. That's from Ben Eady, experienced aeronautical engineer. Now, Joe Keith has been willing to qualify his claim about exactly what would be going on there, and there's some debate even about whether the plane could get up to that speed. I think that what John Lear has said and what we got from Ben Eady tends to be decisive here, but I can understand why McConnell would be interested in seeing if he couldn't accomplish the feat.
Yeah. You asked me what was my biggest smoking gun would be actually crash physics. Now you in your list of five you had something about crash physics, didn't you?
Absolutely. The second, the five arguments. The first is, of course, the impossible speed. The second is that the plane enters the building in an impossible fashion, and in here, of course, we're talking about where you can see the plane interacting with the building in Herzegovina's video, for example. It's passing into the steel and concrete structure without displaying any signs of impact, where the wings, the engines, the fuselage, and other component parts all remain intact. It should have been the case that massive debris was breaking off and the plane was being dismantled by the interaction between the moving plane and the stationary building. And, of course, this is one that early critics, and late, from Webb Ferry to Morgan Reynolds, have been making for years. That's the one you consider to be the most important?
For sure. It's just the one that can't be... It can't be logic the way, you know, we can have arguments about Boeing speeds, we can talk about the contradiction in flight paths and different stuff, but there's three or four shots where you can truly see the crash, the supposed crash, and it isn't. And that's the whole thing. If they're the best ones, like if you look at the ghost plane where it's Michael Hezekani, where you're right under the building, you have the best, the best angle. If you can't see anything going on there that looks realistic, then the rest of the little arguments about the videos is pointless, because you've obviously been shown a fate. You know, like for my money, the one thing is the tail not altering its path on the way through. The tail should at least snap off because the upper stabilizer hits the building on the way through, and it should snap down. It should break away.
Yeah.
It should slow down. Something should happen. That's a smoking gun for me. And it doesn't do it on any of the videos.
So, oh, I quite agree completely. I mean, I think it's it is ridiculous. It took me quite a while, by the way, as you perhaps...
I was going to ask you, when did you... Because you had a long time of hugging the plane.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of email debates between Morgan Reynolds and Jared Holmgren. And he still calls me a plane hugger, by the way, Jared Holmgren.
he still calls me an airplane hugger?
Yeah. And I don't think he keeps up with it much anymore, but he doesn't like any of us, I don't think, and it calls us all plane huggers. But where was the point where you what video were you looking at when the hypnotizing sort of stopped, when you saw it?
Well, I think there were two or three stages in it. It took me a very long time to be able to come to grips with it, because I had this psychological blockage of the kind that Anthony is constantly throwing up, where I just presumed there were so many videos and so many eyewitnesses that this was a preposterous claim. But I came to the point where I realized there was a difference between video fakery and planes or no planes, and that even if there had been video fakery, you could still have planes if the video fakery had been intended to conceal some features of the planes or of their interaction with a building that would have given the game away. That enabled me to get an intellectual handle on it, plus an incident that was completely separate and apart, where my son-in-law's parents came over here to Madison from Milwaukee, where they reside, and they wanted to watch a Brewers game, a baseball game on television. And the game was on TV, but they had a favorite announcer you could only hear on the radio. So we set a radio down beside the TV, and to our astonishment, we discovered that the announcer on the radio was so far ahead of what was being broadcast on the television. We knew if the pitcher was going to toss a ball, a strike, whether it was going to be a hit or an out before it even happened. And that said to me, this is really a common occurrence, so that when, for example, Simon Shack emphasized in September Clues' 17-second delay, that created the space, the opportunity for some kind of video skullduggery to take place. So that about a year ago, a year and a half ago, in April of 2007, I began featuring proponents of no planes and video fakery. I had Morgan on. I had Web Ferry. I had Killtown. I had Ace Baker repeatedly, and started going through this. And more I studied, the more convinced I became. Eventually, I had John Lear and Joe Keith. And actually, the argument that convinced me that I found most decisive is number three on my list, to wit, that this what we're seeing here represents uniform motion, not of the plane in the air and in the building, so that as I wrote it up here, let me describe this. The interaction observed also violates all three of Newton's laws of motion. According to the first law, objects in motion remain in uniform motion unless acted upon by a force. According to the second, an object accelerates in the direction of the force applied. According to the third, there's an equal and opposite reaction. But the plane moves at uniform motion through both air and building, which would violate Newton's laws unless the building provides no more resistance or force than air, which is absurd. By most counts, the plane moves its length through air in 8 frames and also moves its length into the building in the same number of frames, which cannot be the case if there are real objects and real interaction. Joe, by the way, has an argument about this entitled Joe's Law, which is on Morgan's website, nomoregames.net. But that was the decisive one for me. It was actually, Genghis, separating the way the plane goes into the building from uniform motion that, to me, gave me the analytical clarity to see that we actually had two decisive arguments here, not just one, and that they needed to be treated disparately rather than merged.
Yeah, I think there's that moment there where you realize I'm just watching something that's been penciled in.
Yeah, it was really stunning. We'll come back to this. Stand by, everyone. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Genghis. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett. Well, you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today from Australia, Genghis, is a student of the videos of 9/11 especially. He's made many contributions, produced several studies, and is a frequent contributor to discussion on Internet websites. Genghis, yeah, just to further elaborate, you know, as a philosopher of science, I'm a student of the principles of scientific reasoning, which fall into four steps or stages. You have the puzzlement, you know, you got something you need to explain. There's something very funny here. Like, you know, and we use this in lots of contexts, like in detective investigations. You got a body, right? And this leads to speculation. Well, how was this person killed? And of course, eventually by whom and for what reason? And here, of course, obviously you have some evidence you acquire, examine the body. Maybe you find that there are no gunshot holes, there are no knife wounds. Maybe there's some abrasions around the throat. Then we have to adapt the evidence to the hypotheses, which would be, of course, in this case, a full range of guns, knives, ropes, whatever. and ask, well, what's the probability of the evidence if, say, for example, a gun was used? Well, the probability of the evidence when there's no gunshot wound if a gun was used is approximately zero. Similar, if there are no knife wounds when a knife was used, if a knife was used, approximately zero. If there are abrasions around the throat, that suggests that strangulation is a possibility. But we want to get additional evidence, send it to the coroner, and conduct a medical examination. And it may turn out, for example, the person was poisoned. They actually died from poisoning, and that while there were abrasions, they came from some kind of struggle, but what the actual cause of death. Now, what this means is that you're looking for the hypothesis which, if true, would confer the highest probability on the evidence, and it's an hypothesis is preferable when it confers a higher probability on the evidence than an alternative. So here I was looking at, you know, planes, no planes, fakery, and trying to figure out what was going on. I wanted a sufficient range of evidence that it had essentially settled down so that I was, the probability, you know, in my own mind that this was video fakery was growing and growing, but I needed to have enough that I was convinced that, it was most unlikely that there really was, that it could be overthrown, that there really was no alternative reasonable explanation. Which, and when I discovered not only these first three forms of proof, which I think are extremely powerful, but also when Killtown observed, or this, let's see, it's called actually 9/11 Amateur Part 2, pointed out that if you study the Nade video very carefully, you can see there's a secondary explosion, and that the cutouts that are supposedly created by the plane going through the building are actually being created by secondary explosions and not by the impact, which was something that was also a feature of the proof you think so important, namely the crash physics, because the cutout, the damage to the building, isn't conspicuous, isn't visible as the plane is melting into the building, even though presumably it's being caused at that point. So it should have been present, but isn't. And the study here in 9/11 Amateur Part 2 really reveals how it was done with these secondary explosions. And then finally, Killtown actually extended his argument to the Evan Fairbanks footage, the argument about uniform motion, and discovered that, again, even with the Fairbanks footage, you can see it's the same number of frames that it takes for the plane to go its whole length and for the plane to, in air, and for the plane to go its whole length into the building. I was kind of astonished when I re-listened to the Impossible Speed video that you have Dan Rather saying how the plane seems to go right into the building, seems to go through the building. It's like the building swallowed it up. So he's actually making observations very early on that are actually indicative of important forms of proof of video fakery. So it's when I put all that together, not to mention that Ace Baker had also provided very convincing evidence in his Chopper 5 composite, and Simon Shack, of course, with the point of the plane, you know, the nose of the plane coming through, which would be an impossibility again because that nose is the most fragile part of the aircraft. It ought to have been completely crushed during the causal interaction. The fade to black, the fact that so many of these people who call in all seem to be producers or writers or somehow connected with these corporations that are broadcasting. I mean, all of this really I found a very powerful combination of evidence. And that's when, of course, I published the piece entitled New Proof of Video Fakery on 9/11. But there was an earlier release that came from scholars entitled More Evidence of Video Fakery that you can find if you go through our press releases.
You see that at Beijing Olympics, they had the fake fireworks recently as well, and people will accept that and go, yeah, that's totally possible, and move on. They won't think about it a second. But if you talk about it during 9/11, it was absurd once.
Or you watch a football game, and there you got the first down line shown, and you know, everyone thinks it's real, and of course it's imposed on the scene as we watch it. And you know, also they had this little Chinese girl sing their anthem at the beginning, and actually she was simply lip syncing, so it looks as though, you know, this kind of deception using videos is commonplace. You know,
I think a lot of people can't believe that they would be that cheeky, because it's okay to do it at Olympics, it's okay, but you know, and governments have created treason on their own people before, but to be that cheeky.
I know, it's really stunning.
Videos, that's what's hard to swallow at first. They're like, you would expect a complicated plot with a great outcome, you know, using the best technology, and really at the end of the day, if this thing was a really simple missile attack with a couple of blobs on video,
yeah,
we all feel a little bit silly, and that's the hard bit to swallow for some people, I think.
Incidentally, I guess we have a caller who'd like to talk with us, Kevin from Kansas City. Kevin, welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Just a quick question, then I'll take the answer off the air. Flight 75 was shot by several cameras as it hit the South Tower.
175.
Is the explosion in all of the camera angles exactly the same, down to the most minute detail in all of the shots? Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great question. Thanks very much for calling, Kevin. Genghis, you want to comment on this? Anthony has talked about the plane coming in with a dive, and it seems to me in the video he's talking about, there's a slight incline that doesn't seem to be consistent with what appears to be a perfectly horizontal approach in other videos. But I'd like your comments on this.
Okay, well, firstly, the trajectories, yes, there is a definite bend in certain trajectories where it comes in on a big swoop, and there's other ones where on several angles it comes in straight as an arrow, like it actually lines up with the bottom of the screen. Now, he said, were the explosions the same? This is a good point, because this becomes the bigger question of, did they fake the entire videos or did they just fake the planes? And no, for my money, the explosions generally do look exactly the same on all the videos. I can't really find too much that's different. Even if they're fake, they generally tend to be the same. That's something the planes don't have. The planes generally are all different. This is why I always thought the fireball's real, the planes are fake, and the scenery's real.
I believe this would be consistent with Ace Baker's concept of video compositing. So I would like, you know, I'm hoping to get him back on to talk about it himself when we have the chance. Stand by.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Genghis. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. We're discussing video fakery on 9/11. Genghis from Australia is my guest. Genghis, I must say I very much like Kevin's question. I think it reflects the fact that Ace calls video compositing, or adding, you know, blending together different videos, taking those of the planes, which weren't in the original, but feeding them into the live feed with the actual explosions that are being caused by, you know, have separate origin. And I have a friend who has told me how many times, I can't count, it looks to him just like napalm going off to create a certain spectacular impression. Because faking those explosions and making them the same would be, I think, probably a physical impossibility. So you mentioned the idea of layering. I suppose this is a very close approximation to what you mean by that.
Yeah, that's the big question within the community now, is not how, you know, if they're fake, but what's going on there, and why don't they work out? And for my money, it would be very easy to put the planes in and leave the general scenery as is, as much as possible, because this creates less errors. Some people believe the whole thing's fake. Hours of footage on all five channels fake. So when it comes to explosions, of course, they have to fake the explosions. Now, this becomes a problem if people can look back and look at every facet of the explosion. It becomes very hard to fake, and for my money, every time I look at the explosion, it looks pretty much the same.
I tried to recollect who pointed out to me that Fox News appears to have been the source for the different videos that were being played on the different channels, and that Fox seems to have done away with its original footage and now only archives footage from other channels, which is a very curious situation. Jack White, by the way, has discovered a stunning evidence of fabrication of evidence of the planes, a stunning proof. He's discovered that in the Naudé Brothers film, you can actually see this area of Church Street. I think it's Church and Marshall that is cordoned off with police tape. Then you, from a Fox video, you can see a van pulling up to that location and a group of FBI agents struggling with something very heavy. And then subsequently, this engine, which turns out to be from a Boeing 737, is sitting on the sidewalk. The sidewalk is completely undamaged. It's quite apparent that it was unloaded from the van as a stage effect, as a prop. And, you know, Jack has just done a lot of brilliant work in relation to JFK, and now he's doing a lot of equally brilliant work in relation to 9/11. But this gig, is really stunning.
He did a Pentagon page, too, if I'm right. That was really good. A photo analysis. But yeah, I'd like to see that. I haven't heard about it.
We haven't trotted it out yet, but it's there. Here's something else. We just got a news report from Citizens for Legitimate Government. Reuters caught with fake pictures from Georgia, media war against Russia. This morning, one can read on the BBC news site, Reuters agency posts horrible pictures of Russian bombardment of allegedly civilian residential buildings. But if you take a closer look, you can see that they have a man who seems to be repeatedly showing up in different photographs. It's really quite stunning. And of course, I've known that there was a misleading claim about Russians attacking the Georgians, when actually the Georgians had made the attack that was being presented in the film, where the cameraman was objecting that his video was being misinterpreted and misconstrued. We have another caller, I'm happy to say. This is Carl from New Hampshire. Carl, you're on the Dynamic Duo.
You really need to go on the Bill O'Reilly show and talk about this TV fakery. Please do it. Please do it, you insane lunatic. Please do it.
I've been on with Bill.
Please
He's not
it.
A very generous host. He wouldn't give the time of day to somebody who took a difference as, you know, an opinion with him. It was very difficult for me to get words in edgewise. But, you know, O'Reilly doesn't even understand the difference between being devoted to your country and despising the administration that has so perverted its values. When I was on with him before, he was claiming that I was a kook who hated my country. When I'm a former Marine Corps officer and I care about my country, I just have utter contempt for those who have so destroyed its standing in the world and who brought us this phony attack on 9/11.
Troy, is that Troy from West Virginia you've got on the line there?
I'm sorry?
Was that Troy from West Virginia you had on the line?
No, he said he was Carl from New Hampshire.
That was Troy from West Virginia.
Again?
Yeah.
Wow, this guy gets around, does he?
Yeah,
very good. Very, very, very good. Well, I don't think O'Reilly has any understanding of any of these issues, you know, and he, as Keith Olbermann regularly points out, he makes a fool of himself almost every single day, so. I think the guy just has too much influence just by virtue of being in that position.
I'm not sure why people discuss his motives anymore. I mean, he became self-parody a long while ago. I think he got to that point where he still gets ratings. He can be a complete dick.
Yeah.
And really, they don't mind. The producers are behind it now. I mean, really, he's not a news service. So, I mean, as long as we're all on the same page, you do get your flag wavers who just still believe what he says. But let's face it, you know, you can't convince them of anything, but... You know, it was not a news service, is it?
Genghis, suppose you were going to explain, you know, video fakery, planes, no planes, to somebody who only has a general understanding of 9/11, and even at that, probably not a very clear understanding. How would you begin? How would you approach it?
It'd be very hard, and in my real life, I try not to go there with people because it can be quite hard work to take them from believing in 19 Arabs with box cutters to the real 9/11 in one conversation can be quite painful, and usually they're not really willing to go through it and go there. You get your usual palette of questions, and to get someone there, it takes them time. And this is where I say the internet's good. It gives people time to settle in with watching docos, checking out evidence. And I didn't believe myself for a year, so why would I expect somebody else to do it in one conversation?
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing we have to deal with. It took you a long time.
Yeah.
It took Morgan a long time. And it takes you a while. There is no getting somebody through it in a conversation. I'll tell people it's not right, something's wrong. If I want to introduce them to it, I'll just introduce them to General Truth or whatever, but some good documentaries. But you can't go straight to physics.
Something I like to use today is to point out the difference between the mode of demolition of Building 7 and the destruction of the Twin Towers. That the Twin Towers were destroyed by some very sophisticated device. They were blown up from the top down. They were turned into very fine dust. And when each floor remaining stationary, waiting for its turn to be blown to kingdom come, and when it's all done, there's no stack of pancakes. Building 7, on the other hand, at 5:20 in the afternoon is destroyed in a classic controlled demolition from the bottom up. You can see one main support column is taken out, so you get this slight kink in the roof, which is intended to cause the building to fall in toward itself. All the floors are moving at the same time, come straight down. There's a massive pile of rubble five floors high. So that these are really very different modes of destruction. In fact, I find it difficult to understand how anyone could want to insist that these were done the same way, using conventional modes of demolition with or without this incendiary called thermite or thermite, because while that might have been true of Building 7, it's quite clear it wasn't true of the Twin Towers. And one of the most fascinating proofs I would point out is the tons of paper that were left over. Genghis, if the conventional explosive generated tremendous heat, high temperatures, and intense fires. You couldn't possibly have all that ton of paper that were completely unaffected by whatever destroyed the Twin Towers.
Yep, that's right.
Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can find Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. Something I think most students in 9/11 don't understand either, Genghis, is that if unconventional modes of demolition were used on the Twin Towers, and it's, in my opinion, the evidence is overwhelming, and it's not just the turning of the concrete and steel and the office furniture and the human beings and other living things into very fine dust, where 1,100 bodies, for example, were never recovered, not even a fingernail, but that this is a clear indication of the involvement of the government. I mean, this kind of weaponry is the privileged access of the military-industrial complex. If it was used here, then that directly implicates the government in a way that no combination of conventional explosives, RDX or whatever with thermite and thermate ever could. Those are all available easily on eBay. But they also can't account for the devastation, including to all of the other buildings, including, of course, the toasted cars and a lot of other phenomena. But in a like manner, video fakery implicates the media in collusion with the government, the intelligence agencies, in a devastating fashion. And the reason I think that there's such an intense opposition to its exposure is because none of these entities or agencies want to have their methods exposed. You know, they might get revealed as having been complicit in some individual operation, but the methods are what they have cultivated and want to use over and over and over again, so that if, for example, some kind of video fakery by virtue of editing the film occurred and was the backbone of the cover-up and the assassination of John F. Kennedy, they don't want that revealed because they want to have the opportunity to edit other films and do other forms of video fakery in the future. And of course, if they have done so here and we don't reveal it, then we leave ourselves vulnerable to its repetition, its repeated use. And of course, we've reached a point where most Americans, for example, tend to believe what they see on television. You know, if they don't see it on television, they think it isn't real. If they see it on television, they tend to think it is.
Yeah, well, now they want the brainwashing to continue. They get in their soft world in front of their box of KFC and the TV show. But they're also trying to think that that's what politics is for, is to get us out of these situations, when really the TV's the problem and it's right there all the time. It's not voting once every 4 years. It's the fact that they're telling us what's acceptable every day, every minute, you know, when people are sitting in front of these stupid things. And they don't want you to know that they'll fake some photos and call it news, because that's the Orwellian nightmare, not the voting regime, not the capitalism versus, you know, it's not about that. It's about brainwashing from the TV level of having them in the lounge room, you know, training people's thinking every day, every minute of every day. And a lot of people now accept it to be so. They have really resigned themselves to they're in that part of the matrix where they've taken gutless coloured pill, you know, where they just want to opt out and go, well, it's too hard and I want this reality because it's soft and I've got my mortgage.
Joe Keith, in my opinion, has made many brilliant contributions to these discussions, and here's a paragraph I want to read from a relatively recent one. Now, he says, you may ask, what good does proving TV fakery do? We already know that 9/11 was an inside job. Well, here's what it does. It not only shows U.S. government complicity, but it also shows the co-complicity of the establishment media. And because of this, the media have, albeit not so cleverly, designed a last resort method to protect itself. It claims to have proof that all videos that show frontal WTC-2 views of Flight 175 entering the tower were taken by freelance reporters and sold along with all rights to the networks. The names of these freelancers include Michael Herzakani and Evans Fairbanks and others. The media's defense, therefore, will be, we didn't fake these videos, we merely bought them, believing them to be actual videos of the catastrophe as it occurred. So the question now becomes, when this fakery is exposed with the little people, that is all of us, still believe the big lie?
Yeah, well, I think this is how part of it was pulled off, though. It was a middleman scapegoat thing where the media knows they're fake. They were handed these tapes by, you know, the men in black. And really at that point, they're saying these are real, and the media has to shut up and do what they're told as well. So, but there's a cover-up to the point where they've got to know these tapes are suspicious, and they just play, it's not our fault, it's not our fault. And the people who took the videos can do the same thing. They can say, we gave them to the men in black, it's not our fault, it's not our fault. And I believe a lot of these people have gone along with the story. Once the tapes come back with a smudge in them that looks like a plane, they've gone along with the story merely because they don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They are just told, yeah, that's the plane, and they so they shut up and they keep, who are they to say any different?
Here's what I think now, and then we have a spokesman who does an absolutely dazzling job of getting across complex points in a simple way. For example, Jesse Ventura, who's been living in Mexico for the last 3 years as a consequence of a contract he had for a television program on MSNBC, where if the program were discontinued, which it was after about 8 broadcasts, then for 3 years he was obligated not to appear on any news show or personal interview or talk about politics. But now he's that's done and he's back, and he'll go on TV and talk about 9/11 and just ask simple questions like, how can you destroy 3 buildings with 2 planes? Because, of course, Building 7 wasn't hit by any plane, had none of these jet-based fuel fires. And so there's one really nice, simple question. He'll also say, well, he was there a couple days later and looked at where the Twin Towers had been, and there were no pancakes. Well, according to the government, there was some kind of pancake floor-by-floor occurrence. We know it's a physical impossibility on many grounds, but here Jesse making the simple point there were no pancakes. Or when, of course, the question arises about the temperature of the fuel not having been hot enough, or the fires not burning long enough to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt, Jesse will simply make the point that the propane in his camping stove burns hotter than kerosene, so why doesn't his camping stove melt when he uses it when he's out in the wilderness? I mean, these are devastating points that are made in such a simple way that it's extremely effective for even the most naive.
Yeah, well, at least, and as well with points like the propane's under pressure too. The kerosene was just floating around in the air under no pressure. It's hilarious. It's good that we have spokesmen. I mean, for me, it's a bit too much on WTC7 can slow us down, really. But yeah, it's good to have people out there saying things like this. Yeah.
And of course,
people are ready to hear it.
If kerosene will, you know, some people respond, yeah, but there was this huge amount of jet fuel. But if the kerosene doesn't burn hot enough to cause the steel to even weaken or melt, it doesn't matter how much of it there is. NIST studied some 236 samples of steel selected from the crash site, the destruction site, and found that 233 hadn't been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, and the other two not above 1200. Well, Underwriters Laboratory, as you know, had certified the steel to 2,000 degrees for 3 to 4 hours before, without showing any adverse effects. And of course, in this case, the steel, the fires were burning at much lower temperature. In fact, the kerosene-based fires burned out in about 15 or 20 seconds. And all you had were normal office fires that burn around 500 degrees. So that's why the evidence that the NIST has admitted having in its possession confirms that its account of what actually happened is a false account.
Yeah, well, it is, and it's, you know, it stinks really as an account anyway.
It's like the claim made about the Building 7 that it had these big diesel tanks, but diesel is non-explosive and doesn't burn at a high temperature. So, I mean, there again, you have an inadequate cause for the alleged effects. And I'm sure you love how at 4:57, Jane Stanley on the BBC was announcing that the Solomon Brothers building had collapsed, where looking over her left shoulder, you could see Building 7 in the background, which, of course, was the same as the Solomon Brothers building she claimed had already collapsed. I don't know if there's ever been a better example of a network being caught with its pants down than this particular illustration, Genghis.
Perfect example.
Hey, I want to thank you, my friend, for staying up late, getting up early here down in Australia. You're doing great work. Keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Thanks for the song.
Real pleasure having you on the air. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank you all for listening.